My name is Robert Kiyosaki. I'll be talking about a subject called money and investing. And my rich dad said to me years and years ago that money is just an idea. So money will be anything you think it is, anything you want it to be. So for instance, if you say, grow up to be a hardworking man or woman, then that's what you'll do for money. You'll be a hardworking man or woman. Or if you say money is hard to get, then that will be true also. And unless a person changes their ideas, nothing outside of them will change. The good news is that if you want to be rich and wealthy, it's as simple as changing your ideas, your thoughts, your words. The bad news is, for some people, those are the hardest things to change. And my purpose is to maybe disturb some of your core beliefs, some of your ideas, because I want people to start thinking in different ways and maybe finding thoughts that work better for themselves.
Now, you too can learn Robert Kiyosaki's Rich Dad Secrets. In this Nightingale Conant recording, author-entrepreneur Robert Kiyosaki candidly shares his philosophies on money, business, investing, financial freedom, and a host of other important topics that affect all of us in this new information age. Robert has shown millions how to succeed with these secrets. Now you can profit from them too. Now let's listen and absorb from Robert Kiyosaki's wisdom and his Rich Dad's secrets.
I wrote a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which was a true story about my two fathers. I'm a fourth-generation Japanese-American growing up in Hawaii. My real dad was a Ph.D. in education. I think he graduated from university in less than 2 years. Straight-A student, very smart man. He was the head of education when I was in high school. If it wasn't for my dad, who was a very good man, very smart academic man, I would probably still be in school today, because he told me that there was a difference between school smarts and street smarts. So at the age of 9, I met my rich dad. And my rich dad was my best friend's father. And my best friend's father ultimately became one of the richest men in the state of Hawaii. When you look at the white sand beaches and the palm trees and the big hotels, he owned not the buildings but the land under those buildings. And that's what made him so rich. So Rich Dad, Poor Dad is a true story based upon two fathers, very strong, honest men, talking to their sons, my best friend and I, about the subject of money. And that's what Rich Dad, Poor Dad's about. And in this program, I will go farther than I have in any book or tape I've ever gone into before. So as my two dads had different ideas and philosophies about money, so do many people in real life have these different philosophies. For example, my poor dad would tell me, study hard, go to school, get good grades, and then find a good company to work for. Whereas my rich dad would say, don't be silly, study hard, get good grades, but learn how to buy good companies so you can own the company. One dad said, I'll never be rich because I have you kids. And the other dad said, I have to be rich because I have you kids. One dad always said, I can't afford it. And the other dad forbade us from ever saying, I can't afford it. My rich dad always asked us to say, how can I afford it? And the moment you do that, you actually task your brain to start thinking. One dad believed in the company or the government taking care of you and your needs. He was always concerned about pay raises, retirement plans, medical benefits, sick leave, vacation days, and other perks. The other dad believed in total financial self-reliance. He spoke out against the entitlement mentality and how it was creating weak and financially needy people. He was emphatic about being financially competent. My poor dad always said, when it comes to money, play it safe and don't take risks. And my rich dad said, learn to manage risk. So those were some of the differences in opinions between two fathers, especially the difference in ideas about the subject of money. And those little differences have made tremendous differences over their financial lifetimes. On October 11th, 1998, Merrill Lynch ran full-page ads in many national newspapers, and the headline of their advertisement read, "The world is 10 years old." And what they were referring to was that the Berlin Wall had come down in 1989. For those of you who are students of economic history, many of you know that the industrial age started around 1492, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Eras like the agrarian age, the industrial age, seem to go in 500-year increments, or there's great changes in humanity every 500 years. So in 1492, there was a great upheaval, a great change, new ideas. You know, Columbus proved that the earth was not flat, it was round, that he could, and he made a big mistake trying to go to China, but he bumped into a great country called America, and the world changed dramatically because of that. Well, here we are again, approximately 500 years after Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and what has happened is the industrial age is now ending, and the information age is now beginning. So many economic historians use the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 as the benchmark or as the event that heralds in the change. The interesting thing about this change is when the Berlin Wall came down, the Cold War ended and globalization began. And at that moment, the rules changed. During the Cold War, what counted was the weight of your missiles. How big were your missiles? How much payload could it deliver? In the information age, it's not the weight of your missiles that counts anymore. It's the speed of your modem that counts. During the Cold War, there were two superpowers. In the information age, no one's in control. During the Cold War, the formula was E equals MC squared. In the information age, it's Moore's Law that counts. And Moore's Law is the law that states that the power of processing, of information processing, doubles every 18 to 24 months. During the Cold War, tradition counted. In the agrarian age, people really counted on traditions, the things, and things to hang on. In the information age, it's innovation that counts. But to me, the thing that is most exciting, given that although I didn't do well in school, I did very well in economic history. I love economics. Was that during the industrial age, the two preeminent or the key economists were men named Karl Marx and John Maynard Keynes. The interesting thing is in the information age, the two people or the two economists that I think have the lead thoughts right now are a man named Schumpeter, who was a professor at Harvard, I think the Austrian Minister of Finance, and the other person is Andy Grove, the chairman of Intel. And what happened during the industrial age was that Marx and Keynes, what they tried to do was control the power of capitalism. So what Schumpeter and Grove believed is that this new unleashed capitalism will greatly brutalize and batter anybody who's still thinking with old industrial age ideas. So much of this program is really about having you examine your current ideas, your current beliefs, and hopefully, and maybe if they're not already changing, change your ideas or thoughts into what I consider information age ways of thinking about money, employment, business, and investing. The thing that Schumpeter and Grove talked about, or as Grove's book said, is only the paranoid survive. In other words, according to Moore's Law, where the chips are doubling in power every year, you may be the king of the heap today, but tomorrow you may be out of business. So for those of you who are considering working for, looking for job security and all this, if the leaders of your company are not changing as rapidly as technology is changing, your job security may be wiped out. For example, there are certain industries that are doing extremely well because of this information age, i.e. Amazon, AOL, and those companies. You know, you have 20-year-olds who are billionaires all of a sudden. At the same time, you have other businesses who are being pounded by this information age. For instance, a friend of mine owns a series of car dealerships, and he had them in very remote parts of little country towns, and he thought he was safe because he was the only car dealer in that town. But suddenly, everybody in his town just clicks onto the web, and they can now shop for a price all over the U.S. In businesses called your margin. So instead of getting a $5,000 per car, he now has to get $500 per car because his competition is on the web as well as he is. So the web for him, an industrial age type of company, has really leveled the playing field. Another friend of mine is a travel agent. She's had a very successful business. Everything's going well. Suddenly, because people can start choosing airline tickets online, airlines have to compete. And what the airlines did to her was they took away her commission. So suddenly she's now competing not so much with the airlines, but with people who have internet websites who can buy tickets without needing her. And the same thing is happening in stock brokerages today. You know, many day traders are going online and trying to muscle out their brokers, saying, we don't need a stockbroker right now. I can bypass a stockbroker and not pay that person commission. So for some people, this information age is really, really opening massive amounts of opportunities. And it's those people who are thinking. For people who are clinging to old industrial age ideas, ideas like my poor dad had, which is get a safe, secure job, employment for life, let the government take care of you, I think this new transition could be frightening them. So for many of my friends, like this travel agent or the person who owns a car dealership, because something has changed when the Cold War ended and the New World opened up, they sort of go back to what I consider industrial age thinking. For instance, my travel agent says, maybe I should get another job with a bigger travel agency. Or my car dealership friend says, you know, maybe I should put in a car detailing shop or something like this. And what they do is they go back to industrial age ideas. The idea of working harder is the way to get ahead. What this program is about is to give you new ideas, new ways of thinking, so that in many ways you can work less, make more money, and take advantage of this great explosion coming about right now called the information age. Although my book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, has reached great popularity, it has also received some flack, should they say. And the reason it's come into some controversy is because I think it's going up against some core values, some core beliefs, some things that are very important to other people that are actually industrial age ideas. And so what I often say to people is my job is to find a sacred cow, shoot it, and barbecue it. And that is my job here with this program. My job is not to insult you, not to devalue your core beliefs. I think that some of the things I may say may shake you, may disturb you. But unless I shake and disturb you, maybe we don't learn that much. So the purpose of my doing this program is to maybe rattle some of the core beliefs you may have, some of the ideas, and hopefully you'll come up with new ideas that'll take you into new directions to take advantage of the changing world. So some of these sacred cows, should I say, of the industrial age are find a safe, secure job. And my poor dad, that was everything to him. To him, job security was everything. The unfortunate thing was that he's being a very honest man, being in government. He was fired at age 50 because he could no longer put up with the corruption he saw in government. And so although I didn't really get along with my poor dad as the years went on because he was more socialistic and I was pretty capitalistic as a young man, I did gain a tremendous amount of respect for him for the ability to stand up, even though it was unpopular, even though he knew he was going to lose the election. He was a Republican in the state of Hawaii, and Forbes magazine called Hawaii, the state of Hawaii, the People's Republic of Hawaii. And my poor dad, the school teacher, the superintendent of education, the PhD, had the guts to stand up and run for lieutenant governor knowing he was going to get wiped out. And when he got wiped out, his boss, the governor, called him in and says, you'll never get a job in state government again. And there went the idea of the safe, secure job. So at the age of 50, my poor dad, a very honorable man, very big-hearted man, was now obsolete. So instead of the idea of a safe, secure job and a secure retirement, he wound up getting poorer and poorer the older he got. And it really broke my heart, very simply because he did not seem to be able to grasp the changes that had come onto his life, changes that are facing and will face many people as we move more and more into this information age. As Andy Grove of Intel says, only the paranoid will survive. That means those who are continually looking over their shoulder, continuing to make changes very quickly will survive. So the idea of a safe, secure job is really obsolete, especially when you look at this thing called the 401k. What the agreement was in the industrial age is that, you know, you got out of school, you joined the company, you worked hard, you got your pay raises, and if you kept your nose clean and you worked your way up the corporate ladder, and voila, at age 65, you retired, you had a company pension, you had a government pension, and hopefully you had some savings. And life was happy, and you could cruise around the country club in your little golf cart. Well, that was a great idea for anybody born before 1935. For those born after 1935, the worlds have changed. And one of the biggest changes with the agreement or the rules of employment was they shifted from a company pension plan to this thing called a 401k. The difference is a company pension plan is called a defined benefit pension plan. And a defined benefit pension plan is an industrial age pension plan, which means the company will give you a benefit, defines as benefit, for as long as you live. So if you retire at age 65 and hopefully live to 165, the company will pay you a defined benefit for 100 years or for as long as you live. Now, if you live to 66, the company wins. If you live to 165, you win. But at least you were secure in that era. One of the things that shocked me back in the 70s, I noticed these things called 401ks coming in or superannuations, and these are defined contribution pension plans. And I call these information age pension plans. And although they're very good, in other words, a company will give you a 50% contribution and all that other stuff, it is still defined by contribution. In other words, you retire at age 65 and you have, let's say, hopefully $1 million in it when you retire. And let's say the stock market crashes. See, the problem with a 401k is indexed to the market. So if the market is very high, you're a rich person. But if the market crashes, you're poor. And the problem is if it crashes when you're 85 and you have no money in it at that point, the company is now off the hook. And that's what I mean, one of the changes between an industrial age employment agreement and an information age employment agreement. So when people say, well, is a 401k bad? I'm not saying it's bad. I'm saying it's different. And I'm saying it may not be enough for many people. The other thing that I'm concerned about these new information age pension plans is that it's defined by the contribution. I have companies where several employees are not contributing anything at all, very simply because they don't have anything to contribute. So the company does not match their funds. My prediction is sometime past 2010, 2020, 2030, this change will become reality, or the significance of this change will hit home for many people when they find out they don't have enough money to retire on. And then people say, well, it's no big deal, I'll keep working. Or what other people say is that when I get older, my expenses go down. Yes, some expenses go down, but other expenses go up. For example, if you look at the price of what it costs to be in a nursing home when you're real old and feeble, the cost of being in a nursing home today, as I talk, is around $4,000, $5,000 for an average nursing home. That's more than the person made per month working. So while the 401k is a good idea and many people are doing well by it, my only problem with it is it's really a savings plan, not really an investment plan. Every 75 years, America has had a depression, or the industrial age has had a depression. The last time a depression started was 1930 approximately, so we're close right now. Not that it'll happen, and people are saying things are different, but that's not really true. Things may be different, but some things remain the same. And what remains the same for many people is this thing called a mania, greed, or stupidity. And I think it was Sir Isaac Newton who was caught in the last bubble, you know, back in 1700 or something. It was called the South Sea Bubble. And what happened is the mania of land in America, which is called the South Seas at that time, is the same as the mania going on with internet stocks today. So everybody's just pouring money in. A recent study just came out, for every dollar of wealth produced in America today, 2.6 is also created in debt. So what many people are doing is they're actually borrowing money to put into the stock market, blah, blah, blah. And we all know what goes up must come down. So your 401k may be fat today and empty tomorrow. That's what I'm saying. There's another thing about mutual funds that many people do not know versus real estate. In a mutual fund, you may buy a stock at $50 and let's say it goes to $100 because of the boom. But suddenly if the market crashes, the mutual fund will at that point need to start liquidating to be able to pay redemption. And it needs, you know, people are saying sell, 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 sell. So if a panic sets in, a mutual fund must sell. And what they sell are the best stocks because they're the most liquid. They have the most readily acceptable market. So they sell a stock at 100. The problem is they bought it at 50. There's a $50 capital gains inside that mutual fund. But guess who pays the capital gains? You do. In other words, the fund passes on the gains. And you may have joined the fund, you know, in one day and it crashes the next day. You will pay the gains. So not only is your mutual fund losing value, you'll get a tax bill from the government for all the money you supposedly made. Mutual funds have its place, but in my opinion, as a professional investor, I wouldn't bet my retirement on it. The difference within real estate, which is quite interesting, is one thing nice about real estate is they'll let you borrow 90% of it. You know, if you notice, a bank will let you borrow 90% of the price of real estate. But if you, let's say I went to XYZ Bank and I said, okay, here's a $100,000 piece of real estate. Will you give me $90,000 for it? They say, oh, yeah, sure, of course. 30 years, 7%. Of course, of course, of course. But you go to that same bank and you say to them, I want to buy $100,000 worth of your shares. Will you give me 90% of the finance, or the borrowed 90% of the money, and will you give me a 30-year loan on it? Of course, they'll say no. Because there is a difference between paper assets, real estate, and businesses. So the average investor, since they've gone to school and never been taught much about business or investing, really doesn't know the differences. The other thing that's wonderful about real estate is I can make a profit and be given a tax deduction on my profit. Whereas in a mutual fund, you can lose money, but you'll be taxed on money you never made. So there are such intricacies or reversals that the purpose of this program is not to give you all the answers, but maybe inspire you to study further, just so that if you have more information, because it is the information age, you'll be better able to survive and thrive in this great booming world we're now entering. Another sacred cow I'm going to go after is this popular idea that the way to get rich is by being cheap. You know, cut up your credit cards, live below your means. Personally, I think that's ridiculous. Now, I'm not saying that being frugal is not the thing to do. Frugality has its place. But my rich dad used to say that the problem with getting rich by being cheap is that you're still cheap. And people who are rich and cheap give the rich a bad name, i.e. Scrooge gave the rich a bad name and Silas Marner gave the rich a bad name because they were rich by being cheap. And unfortunately, from my perspective, there's many people going around touting the idea the way to get rich is to be cheap, to play it safe, and live below your means. That's definitely not what this program is about. Frugality has its place, but it's not everything. To spend your life living cheap and dying rich, to me, is insanity. Yet, another sacred cow, and not really a sacred cow, I think it's the foolish cow, is this idea of affluenza. Too many people who are on fixed incomes and are not living cheap, what they're doing is they're living in the realm of keeping up with the Joneses. I call it affluenza. They're buying big houses on credit because they think they get a tax break for buying a big house. Now, if the government's giving you a tax break, watch out. Because all they're saying to you is, if you give me a dollar in taxes, I'll give you 30 cents back. If that makes sense to you, give me a dollar and I'll give you 50 cents back. But that makes no sense to somebody who's an investor or who is a business owner. The other part about affluenza is many people are living on credit. And that's what really kind of frightens me. They get further and further in debt, and instead of using checks, they're using credit cards. They're looking for different interest rates or different bonuses and all this. Or they watch TV and they have some sports star come on and say, hi, I'm a famous sports star. The smart thing to do is take your credit card debt and roll it into your home equity loan, and the government will give you a tax break for it. And that's the level of sophistication most people are at. They're caught in what I call the rat race of life. They have a high-paying job, and they keep trying to work for a high-paying job. The problem is the more money you make and the harder you work, the harder you're taxed. And because you're taxed harder, the government then says, or your accountant then says, buy a bigger house because you get a tax break. For most people, especially in the middle class, that may be financially intelligent. For my rich dad, he didn't think that was too intelligent. Another sacred cow that my poor dad, the school teacher, very good, honest man, he always said, be a hard-working man. The unfortunate thing with that thinking is that if you look at the facts, the people that work the hardest are often paid the least. And not only are they paid the least, they're often paying the highest percentage in taxes. Most of us know the poor pay a higher percentage of taxes than the rich. And most people do not know why, because our schools never taught people why. Ever since 1215, which was the signing of the Magna Carta, when the rich barons of England went to King John at Runnymede and said, King, you no longer have the power. We're taking over at this point. Ever since 1215, the rich have made the rules. Unfortunately, when you go to school, you're never taught about the differences in the rules. Most people do not realize in America, an employee, somebody who works for somebody else, is taxed by a different tax code. If somebody is self-employed or a small business owner or somebody like a doctor, accountant, attorney, engineer, they're taxed by a different set of taxes. The rich have an altogether different set of taxes. So one of the things my rich dad taught me was if you want to get rich, you really have to understand whose rules you play by. And so some of this program will go into some of the differences in the tax laws and some of the reasons why the rich get richer. And that's why my rich dad often said, if you want to be a good, hardworking man, you'll probably never get rich. And that really disturbs me personally, because given this huge mania of, you know, everybody speculating on the stock market and people just want to get rich quick and all this, it is the people who are actually doing the work who are being left the furthest behind. And again, that's an industrial age idea. And part of this program is to maybe inspire, maybe educate, but most importantly, start, have you start thinking differently so that you're not falling behind and you can start moving ahead into this brave new world we enter. So one of the reasons my poor dad had a really hard time getting ahead was because he was a hardworking man. That's an industrial age idea. And he was taxed to the max. The harder he worked, the more in taxes he paid. And my rich dad, on the other hand, because he understood the tax laws, the less he worked, the more money he made, the less he paid in taxes. And for most people, taxes are your highest expense, except for the rich. Another sacred cow that my rich dad had me examine or shoot and barbecue was the idea of get a good education from a prestigious university. Now, I'm not saying a good education from a prestigious university is not a good idea. I think it's an excellent idea. The problem with it, in the industrial age, where all you had to do was get a job, you know, if you went to Harvard or Yale, it was the ticket in. But if you notice today in the information age, Bill Gates dropped out of school, Michael Dell dropped out of school, Henry Ford was considered an idiot, and Thomas Edison, the founder of the biggest company in the world, General Electric, was considered a moron. The point I'm making here is that today, to be successful, you need school smarts as well as street smarts. Unfortunately, some of the things you learn in school are considered bad habits that prevent you from being successful on the street. Such an example is in school, you learn not to make mistakes. In the real world, the people that make the most mistakes make the most money. And the biggest granddaddy sacred cow of them all, my poor dad always said, our house is an asset and it's our largest investment. And my rich dad always said, number one, if you're financially literate, you'll know that your house is not an asset for most people. And if it's your largest investment, you're in big financial trouble. Now, in the industrial age, it was okay that your house be your largest investment simply because you could count on your company pension and Social Security or government pension to take care of you, so you didn't really need a pension. But in the information age, you don't want your house to be this biggest investment. You want your portfolio or your 401k to be a lot larger than your house. And that's one of the big changes that's happening today. Many people are counting on their real estate as the only thing they can fall back on. And the problem with falling back on it is they've already second and triple mortgaged the thing because they're so deeply in debt. The reason my rich dad said it's not an asset goes back to what rich dad, poor dad was about, was the importance of financial literacy. If you can read a financial statement, you will see that your house, for most people, is not an asset. It's really a liability. The word mortgage comes from the French word mortier, which means death. So the real word for mortgage means engagement until death. And that's what's happening to more and more of the middle class, is that they're working hard, paying excessive amounts of taxes. They're told to buy a big house, so they get into debt. And then because they have a hard time making ends meet sometimes, they buy more and more on credit cards, getting further in debt, buying bigger cars, all thinking that they're assets. Meanwhile, because the stock market is running up so high, many people are borrowing even more money to put into the stock market. That is what my rich dad would say, lack of sanity maybe, and really a lack of some degree of financial intelligence and literacy. So one of the simple things I learned from my rich dad when I was 9 years old, if you're financially literate, what determines if something is an asset or a liability is not what your banker calls it or your real estate broker calls it. What determines if something is an asset or a liability is a very important word, probably the most important word in business and investing. The word is cash flow. In other words, if the cash is flowing into your pocket, the house is an asset. So for myself personally, I have a lot of rental properties. And every month, the cash flows into my pocket from that real estate. My personal residence, the cash flows out of my pocket. So my rich dad would say my rental properties are assets, but my personal residence is a liability because the cash is flowing out. One of the reasons people struggle financially, and I'm not saying don't buy a house and don't buy a big house, and I'm not saying live cheaply and frugally because I don't believe in that, but the most important thing is if you want to be successful in the new era we're going into, you really do need to know the difference between an asset and a liability, and that requires financial literacy. And in this program, I will be showing you how to reduce some of your investment risk by increasing your financial literacy, as well as sharing with you how the rich get richer by using different sets of tax laws. So although I had a rich dad teaching me many things, I still came from a relatively poor family. So I'm not one of these rich kids whose daddy gave him a lot of money, a big trust fund, and a company to inherit. That was not my case. In fact, back in 1985, my wife and I were homeless. And the reason we were homeless was because one of my businesses had failed. And the reason I say that is not to make it sound dramatic. It's just to explain to people that I had to come off the streets. I had to come from tremendous amounts of setback and loss to achieve what I've had to achieve today. All my rich dad gave me was information. The information of how to start from wherever you are today to become very wealthy in the future. And that's what this program intends to share with you, is some of the insights, some of the wisdom, and my rich dad's greatest secret on how to become a wealthy person in a very short period of time. So I know I may have disrupted some of your thoughts and maybe some of your core beliefs, but I want to reassure with you that when I share with you my rich dad's secret, and his greatest secret of all when it came to money, business, investing, was that in those arenas, it's almost impossible to lose. The reason many people are not successful is because they say, I don't want to invest because it's risky, or I don't want to start my own business because it's risky, or what happens if I lose money, or what happens if I fail. My rich dad's greatest secret is that in the world of business and in the world of spirituality even, that the world is set up for us to win and not to lose. People get rich and others don't. I think that question can be answered from the diagram known as the cash flow quadrant. You'll find the cash flow quadrant in your workbook, which is included as part of this program. My rich dad said there's four different types of people in business: the E, the S, the B, and the I. E stands for employee, S stands for self-employed or small business, B stands for big business or business owner, and I stands for investor. So the answer why do some people make more money than others can be found in the cash flow quadrant. Before answering the question more specifically, let's get into the different people found in the quadrant. On the left side of the cash flow quadrant is the E and the S, which stands for employee and self-employed or small business owner. On the right side of the quadrant is the B and the I, which stands for business owner or big business, and I for investor. In other words, if your cash flow comes from a job, or in America, a W-2, then you're an employee. If your income comes primarily from your investments, for example, my wife and I, we're I quadrant simply because right now most of our income comes from investments. So that's how I know I am, is where the cash flow comes from. If you're self-employed and you can't stop working, then you're obviously self-employed. And a B quadrant business owner is somebody who has a business but can leave it at will and the income still continues to come in. So what determines which quadrant you're in is very simply, from which quadrant does your cash flow come from? And that's why it's called the cash flow quadrant. So if you're on the left side, you're on the E and the S, and the right side, you're the B or the I. The cash flow pattern of a poor person, most of their income comes from a job. The money comes in and goes out the expense column, money in and money out. The cash flow pattern of a middle-class person also comes from a job. Money comes in, but because they have better credit history, they have lots of things called liabilities. The reason you know something's a liability is because the liability will also show up on the expense side of the financial statement. So money comes in, the liabilities then trigger a monthly payment, and the money flows out the expense column again. What makes the rich rich is they have cash flow that doesn't come from a job. It actually comes from the asset column. For example, my wife and I own businesses and real estate and stocks. So the reason we don't have to work is the cash flow flows out of our asset column into our income column, and it's income from our assets that pays off our expenses. That's why we're financially free today. My rich dad said, if you're going to be a business owner, the B quadrant person, you had to be able to understand the four people found in the world of business. In other words, he says, you can tell an employee by simply listening to their words. He says, an employee will always say, I'm looking for a safe, secure job. Is the moment you hear that, you know that the quadrant they come from, or their core values, or their belief system comes from, is from the, what they call the employee mindset. The highest value for the E quadrant is security. In other words, what drives them sometimes is fear or uncertainty. They don't like it, so they seek security as a response. The S quadrant, which is the self-employed or small business owner, he said you can always tell that person because their words are different. Their words go, I'm going to charge you $100 per hour, or my commission is 6%, or I'll get to it next week. I don't have time this week because I'm all tied up. The value of an S or a small business owner is independence, or they don't trust other people. Their theme song is Nobody Does It Better, or Frank Sinatra's song I Did It My Way. You can often tell an S quadrant person because in their minds, they're legends. I'm the best. Like, I go to my chiropractor, and in his mind, he's the best chiropractor in the world. I go across the street, and he says, nah, you shouldn't go to him because I'm the best in the world. So oftentimes, the S stands for highly specialized also. It also stands for very smart, because in the S quadrant, you'll find the smartest people from school. That's where you find the doctors, accountants, attorneys, engineers. That's what else it stands for. It also stands for solo. They like to do things on their own. So they're a completely different breed of cat. The S quadrant, in my opinion, is the riskiest simply because they have very little safety nets under them. For example, a friend of mine is a consultant. He lives in the mountains of Colorado. He was driving home one night with his Land Rover. It slid off the road. He was in the hospital for 6 months. That meant his family had no income coming in. He had lots of liabilities. On top of that, the government taxes the S quadrant much harder than the B quadrant. So the S quadrant not only has employees to deal with, have themselves to deal with, they have the government to deal with, but all of their income is oftentimes predicated upon their production. So that's why S can also stand for the most satisfying. You know, people say, I really love my work. I love being a consultant, or I love being a doctor. But also S stands for the less secure. The thing my rich dad always said, you need to mind your own business. Sometimes the problem with being on the E and the S side is you spend the vast amount of your working hours minding somebody else's business. Your boss's job is not to make you rich. That's your job. The rich will always give people money for the asset, whereas the E and the S thinks that money is the asset. The B quadrant investor knows that the business is the asset, not the money. So they'll always pay somebody. For instance, I'll always pay my employees, and I'll always pay my specialists, my accountants and attorneys, money. But I'll pay them to build my asset. And that asset is more important than the money. So the E and the S side oftentimes values money more than assets. So my rich dad said, if you're going to be a business owner, you had to really quickly understand these types of people. A business owner is looking for something different. A business owner is looking for a system. In other words, McDonald's is a brilliant system of producing hamburgers. There's a lot of small business owners who have hamburger shops, but they don't have a system for producing the hamburger. And an investor, what investors generally do, they invest in B quadrant businesses. They very rarely invest in an employee or a small business. The reason doctors' practices oftentimes don't fetch the high prices like an internet company will fetch is because a doctor's practice is often only purchasable by another doctor. So the market is very limited. So My rich dad said, if you wanted to be very, very rich, this is one of the lessons why some people make more than other people, is that the richest people in the world generally come from the B quadrant. I think it's about 80% is a rough number. When you look at the Rockefellers, the Fords, the Mellons, the Bill Gates, the Michael Dells, they come from the B quadrant. Even Warren Buffett, America's richest investor, actually comes from the B quadrant, same as George Soros. What they did is they made a business, a B, out of their core competency, which is investing. The difference between E and S and the B is a word called leverage. The S business owner cannot afford to leave or stop working. In other words, my rich dad said, you know you're a B quadrant business owner if you can leave your business for a year or more and come back and find the business more profitable and running better without you. That is one of the big keys between a B business owner and an S business owner. The S business owner, if they stop working, very often their income stops also. So as my rich dad said, if you're in the E quadrant, an employee, you have a job. An S quadrant business owner owns a job, and that's the difference. What a B quadrant or a big business person has is they own a system. And when people are talking about high tech today, always remember that Starbucks Coffee created a business system, a B quadrant business around a cup of coffee, and they became a billion-dollar company also. So it is not necessarily high tech. It's a different way of looking at it. The I quadrant or the investor, this is the hard part for most people. I quadrant people generally only invest in B quadrant. So the reason a lot of times E's and S's are not good investors is because they really do not understand the B quadrant. You look at Microsoft is a B quadrant business, where Joe's computer repair shop is an S quadrant business. An investor would rarely invest in a computer consultant, but they'll invest all day long in Microsoft. So a person who is putting money into a mutual fund is not really an investor. All it is a form of investment. They're really savers. In the I quadrant, an investor will say, what's my return on investment, also known as ROI? So the point I'm making here is that between the E, the S, the B, and the I, if a person really wants to become rich, they really need to fully assess their core competencies. In other words, if you're an employee making $50,000 a year, the chances are harder for you to become rich because from the E quadrant, the taxes are the highest. Whereas in the B quadrant, if you work really hard, you can expand or leverage out your time faster than other people. The people in the E and the S quadrant, the reason they have a harder time, not that you can't become very wealthy from the E and the S, you can, but very few do, is because for them, time is money. In other words, a dentist can only work on so many people per day. An employee only has so many hours in a day. So the key word in there is leverage. How much leverage or how much bang for your buck or time can you get? The E and the S are limited. And ironically, the tax laws are written against the E and the S. The best quadrants to get rich in are the B quadrant. You have the most leverage and the most favorable tax laws. Many times people call me up and they say, well, I formed my corporation so I can avoid taxes. That's illegal. The point I want to make here is this. If you do something strictly to avoid taxes, that's called tax evasion. Many people get in trouble because they're trying to avoid taxes. The only way you can use tax laws in your favor is you have to want to be rich. The way the tax laws are written, tax laws are written in favor of people who want to be rich, not in favor of people who want to avoid taxes. So if you form a corporation strictly to avoid taxes, that would be illegal. You'd best have the best legal counsel advice possible because for many people, they operate in gray areas here and I don't want anybody getting in trouble. So the reason the people on the right side of the quadrant pay less in taxes goes back again to my favorite subject, which is financial literacy. If you can read a financial statement, you'll see why the people on the left pay more taxes than people on the right. And it goes to a very simple thing called income statement and balance sheet. For the employee, their first line item expense is taxes. for the B quadrant person, their last line item and expense is taxes. In other words, employees pay taxes first, business owners pay taxes last. In other words, they try and business owner will spend everything they possibly can and then pay their taxes on what's left. In other words, they have a start of $1,000. They may spend $800 in expenses, and they'll pay taxes on only $200. An employee, let's say they make the same $1,000, they're taxed on the $1,000. So the basis, employee is taxed on $1,000, a business owner is taxed on only $200. The tax laws are written in favor of those who want to be rich because the government needs capitalists. They give me tax breaks because I build houses for people, or I start businesses which creates jobs. So the tax laws are written in favor of capitalism and against those who play it secure. So tax laws and tax breaks and tax loopholes are written for the rich and against everybody else. If you can understand that, you can make a big change in your life. My rich dad said, what you want is freedom, which means you don't want to be attached to anything. That you operate, not that there's no fear, but you operate without needing anybody or anything to take care of you. And so a big difference between the employee and the self-employed side is the need for security. And the B and the I side, the business owner and the investor side, is the need for freedom. And I've always chosen freedom. The reason my rich dad explained the cash flow quadrant to me was this. He said, if you're happy being an employee, or you're happy being self-employed and it fulfills everything you want, then stay there. But as we spoke earlier, we're now in the change from industrial age to information age, and many people are wondering why things may not be working for them. A difference could be in your core values. In other words, if your core value is security, like an employee, it might be very difficult to shift over to the B or the I side. If your core value as an S or self-employed is independence, trusting other people as a team in the B side or trusting a financial advisor could be a very difficult process. So the reason I wrote the cash flow quadrant was for people to examine themselves, examine their core values, and decide whether or not making those core value changes are worth making. The path to financial freedom has never been easier. Today we have people becoming billionaires in less than 18 months. And it's due to the information age, or as I said, the difference between the Berlin Wall and the World Wide Web. What needs to change first are the core values and the technological mental skills to make the shift over. So for me, I would say it was pretty difficult because I had industrial age ideas, and making the shift was a hard process because I thought like an old person. Today, it's never been easier if you'll just change your thinking. If security and comfort are very, very high values, the transition may be difficult. Yet it can be done. It starts with education. For instance, on the B and the I side, I learned different things, things that are not taught in school. One of the reasons I think my educational products have been successful is that I bring to the masses of people and have made very simple the information and the education required to be a business owner and investor. For example, when we talk about financial literacy, the reason that most small businesses fail, I think it's 95% fail within the first 5 years, is very simply because the average small business owner, even though they went to a good school, was never taught how to read a financial statement, much less understand the laws. And that's why so many of them fail. In the markets, as far as investors go, 8 out of 10 investors don't make money. Now, it doesn't mean they lose money. It means they just sort of break even. I've had friends who make money one day, and just like at Las Vegas, they give it back the next. So they just break even. And the reason for that is they've really not been taught basic financial literacy, tax law, and corporate law. It is no longer appropriate just to be E, S, B, or I. I think it is more important that we as individuals seek knowledge, wisdom, and skills in all four quadrants, especially when the world is changing so quickly. If you refer to the print component of this program, you will see in there the diagrams of an income statement and a balance sheet. You will also see the cash flow patterns of the poor, the middle class, and the rich. By studying the different cash flow patterns of the rich, the poor, and middle class, you may begin to understand what causes some people to be rich, poor, and the middle class. And a lot of times people say, well, I'd rather be rich than happy, or I'd rather be happy than rich. And that comes from a point of view of scarcity. In other words, they think they have to choose between being rich or happy, or rich and loving what you do. I think Yogi Berra said it best. He says, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. So my whole reason for doing this program is to have people expand their thinking. Why not be rich and happy